3 years ago, Massey University Professor of Politics Richard Shaw published The Forgotten Coast, which was a personal story all about his own family history, and crucially, it zeroed in on the parts of it that didn't get much mentioned in family discussions, and specifically how the land that underpinned his family's security and prosperity over generations had actually been taken from tangata whenua. In his new book, he called that the shady bit beneath our family tree. And that new book is called The Unsettled: Small Stories of Colonisation, and it's a follow-up on The Forgotten Coast, which takes in those with similar stories who were inspired by his book. And it also details some of the pushback that Richard got from people who didn't like him dragging up the colonial past. And he joins me now from Palmerston North. Kia ora, Richard.
Tēnā koe, Colin. How are you?
Good, thanks. You're two guests in a row from Palmerston North. That's quite something.
We're an important place, Colin.
Of course you are. The titans of the Manawatū. Indeed. Richard, first of all, just to go backwards, seeing as this new book did stem from The Forgotten Coast and the way that you dug into past stuff that was awkward for your family, there's a line in the new one that says you perhaps did this because you didn't want your backstory to be reduced to what you called some stock pioneer orthodoxy. But was that really the prompt for you? You felt you had to go back and look at what had really happened and how your family had really developed over generations?
No, I don't. I'd like to claim it was as sort of purposeful or intentional as that, but it wasn't. It was all a bit accidental, that first book, Colin. My dad died, like many New Zealand men. He was a man of few words. There were things that I wish I'd said to him, conversations I wish that we had had. And so The Forgotten Coast began with me just jotting some of that stuff down. In my day job, I do lots of writing, and so one of the ways that I deal with stuff is to try to put it into words. And then that book just sort of morphed into a series of other things. But the discovery that my great-grandfather on my mum's side, Andrew Gilhooly, had been a member of the armed constabulary, had been present for and participated in the invasion of Parihaka. He'd stayed on for the 4 years' worth of occupation that followed the invasion, which I had no idea about. And then he came back, and with his wife, Kate Fleming, farmed three pieces of land, which were all on the 1,200,000 odd acres that had been confiscated from Taranaki Māori in 1865. All that stuff, I just stumbled upon it by accident. What it has done, amongst a bunch of other things, has given me a lot of good reasons to have just a bit of a think about the sort of conventional settler story, the pioneer story that I've always subscribed to. You know, that story always begins with the purchase of the family farm or leaving someplace over there and arriving here. But it tends, certainly in my case anyway, to exclude the bad stuff. It certainly in my case excluded any consideration of how it was that my ancestors came into that land. There was nothing in my family law whatsoever about the armed constabulary or parihaka or confiscated land that had just all dropped down the back of the sofa, really. So it was all a little bit accidental, but it's been unsettling, Colin.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess as a result of this, you also learned a bit more about how your Irish antecedents were also, you know, pushed off land and impoverished for generations, you know, before coming to this part of the world.
Yeah, and that's not a thing that had occurred to me either. I mean, I think what happened, for very good reasons, those people came out of terrible circumstances in Ireland. My great-grandparents left in the early 1870s, so they are 30 years on from the worst of the famine. But the scars of that terrible time would have been engraved deeply in them. And so I can entirely see why they would perhaps want to completely forget about Ireland and sail as far away from that place as they possibly could get. So in my family, there were no stories about Parihaka, but there weren't any stories about Ireland either. And so the more I dug into this stuff, the more byways I went down, the more it became clear to me that there was this weird paradox between my great grandparents came from a people who'd been dispossessed in their own land, and I now have historical records courtesy of an Irish bloke called Eddie O'Day, who's an historian in Limerick, which is where my people came from, which can trace the history of the land on which my great grandfather was born back 200 or 300 years at the time that it was taken by the English. So my grandparents, my great grandparents came from a people who were dispossessed in their own land, but they came out here and they were part of the process of dispossessing another people. And so there is a paradox or there is a contradiction there, which I think many people whose ancestors came from the Highland clearances or the colonized parts of Ireland and Wales and perhaps and the working people from England, people who had terrible lives and who escaped those places to come and build a better life. In the case of the Irish, and specifically the case of my great grandfather, there was just this really big, stonking great contradiction in that he came from a place of dispossession, but he participated in the confiscation of and the benefiting from the confiscation of other people's land here. So that is something that I'm still getting my head around.
Yeah, and there are others who have sort of looked back with Taranaki in mind and confiscations. Recently, the journalist Bernard Hickey, for example, wrote about acknowledging that his life had been simpler and he'd had options because his grandfather had acquired land from the Crown, which he says, and he hadn't done much research when he did. He discovered it was almost certainly land the Crown shouldn't have owned in the first place to pass on to his grandfather, and he acknowledged that. Of course, going back a few years, Andrew Judd, new Plymouth mayor, declaring himself a recovering racist and digging into his past. He was accused of, being a virtue signaller and all sorts of stuff then. But you got, and it's all in the new book, quite a bit of similar sort of hostile feedback, didn't you, from publishing The Forgotten Coast?
There are some people didn't react all that well to what I had to say, and there are quite a few people out there who I don't think would enjoy my company. And it's not an unusual reaction. I think if you start prodding around at some of those foundation stories that we Pākehā in particular tell about the settlement of this place, if you start suggesting that actually the settlement of Aotearoa New Zealand was profoundly unsettling for the people who were here before our lot arrived. People not unexpectedly respond in all kinds of different ways. And a couple of those ways, the primary way is anger. There was a reasonable amount of pretty angry correspondence that I received. And I've thought a lot about that, and I pay quite a bit of attention to that question of anger in the unsettled. And one of the things that I read while I was writing that book was a piece by Ursula Le Guin, in which she talks about the fear that lies behind all anger. And I try to think about that and think, well, if that is the case, if she's right, what is it that people are frightened of? What would be so unsettling for a person that they would write a highly abusive, vituperative email to me, complete with pictures?
Yeah, in
And I
fact, one I'll just read one out just because this is in the book, just to give people a flavour of what we're talking about. We needn't dwell on it, but this is to you. You're just a useless dick, filling people and kids with garbage to look good, your fellow racists. I bet you can't even change your car tyre, you dick. Snowflakes like you are a curse on the country, etc., etc. You said that one came with pictures. I'd perhaps don't need to know what pictures they were,
No,
but I mean, others say, making a slightly different point, but one guy called Thomas wrote to you, say, look, honestly, you should acknowledge Māori are 1,000 times better off since coming under Queen Victoria's rule, and pointing out other colonists were worse. And maybe trying to engage with what you're writing a bit more than that. But
yeah, I think
is
so.
that the tone of it?
Well, the tone was more the snowflake dig guy, and can I just say, as it happens, I can change a tire. But I think the email from Thomas was perhaps an attempt to say, well, there is also this other stuff. Well, really, it's a form of whataboutism, but what about? And so lots of the whatabouts are about, well, what about the cannibalism and what about the musket wars and what about these other things? And there are legitimate conversations to be had about that. But one of the issues that I have with whataboutism is that it's a tool for deflecting attention away from what happened here and the consequences of what happened here. It's an attempt to try and convince us to look somewhere else. And typically, the what about the racism will zip across the Tasman and it will go to Australia. And lots of the whataboutism will be, well, they've got actual racism over here, and we have some slightly benign version of that thing in this country. We have the great race relations story. So I think the anger and the whataboutism and the denial, and they're all attempts to shut down conversations that people are awkward about, people have concerns about. And I think fundamentally, if Ursula Le Guin is right, and what lies behind anger is fear, then I wonder if the fear is that the country that we imagine ourselves to be, it's called into question. That benign pioneer story, it's a hero story, really. It's a great epic of people who left terrible places and came here and made better lives for themselves. And they absolutely did. There's no question that that is what my great-grandparents managed to achieve. And they pass on the material and the immaterial benefits of that to subsequent generations, including me.
Yeah, there is a sense, isn't there, Richard, that sorry to interrupt you, but that people are sensing that you're kind of disrespecting the pioneer story by bringing this stuff up, right?
Yeah, and I'm not doing that. I don't feel guilt. We can have that conversation, because that's the other accusation that is levelled at anybody who asks these questions. And I'm not disrespecting anybody. I'm really clear, both in the Forgotten Coast and in the new publication, that it's inappropriate and it's wrong to judge people's actions as if they had perfect knowledge of everything that they were doing in their present and of the future. I mean, that would be a terrible standard to hold anybody to, and I don't do that. So I'm not suggesting that anybody's ancestors were necessarily bad people or evil or malign or malevolent. But I am suggesting that those of us who can look back on history with the benefit of the scholarship of people like Paul Diamond and Rachel Buchanan and Vincent O'Malley and Joanna Kidman and others, it's incumbent upon us to take responsibility for making a better sense of that pioneer story. So you can have the pioneer story, but I think it makes more sense to include the other stuff as well. So it's a better story, or it's more balanced, or it's more truthful, or it's less self-serving. So there's no disrespect of other people's ancestors. There's just a request. There's a request that those of us who know more now than perhaps our ancestors did, stop forgetting those things, stop putting them to one side, stop suggesting that they're not relevant, or that history is in the past and we should move on, and that these things don't talk to each other. It's absolutely not the case. That history has consequences for us today and into the future. So I think there is probably a slightly nuanced or different kind of pioneer story that we could tell.
Yeah, so is that why you quote that title of that Gloria Steinem book of essays from a few years back? The truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off.
Yeah. There are a lot of pissed off people out there, and some of them will remain pissed off and will refuse to find the truth.
But the guts of the new book, though, Richard, is not so much that. It is that other people responded in a different way by taking on a similar exercise to yourself, by going back, looking at their own family histories. And, you know, as you say, some of the people doing this, you know, possibly not that different from ones you work with, live next door to, pick up the kids at school with, and all of that. So who were the people, the so-called unsettled, who read your story, The Forgotten Coast, and, you know, got in touch with you to share, you know, their own similar stories and how they dug into their own past?
Well, they're just really normal people, and they are literally the people you share this place with. There's a guy who was a bus driver. There's a bloke who used to be a cop. There are a couple of nuns. There are a number of old people. There are young people. There are women, men, a couple of Māori people, the Pākehā people. I mean, they're just sort of normal people. They're real New Zealanders who got in touch with me, and lots of them. I mean, there are lots of them, and they are reflecting on their own histories. They are wondering why they grew up with some stories but not others. They're wondering about the consequences of the new information that they have found. And they're doing things. The chapter that you just quoted from is called Doing Stuff, because we're New Zealanders, so we like doing stuff. I think talking about stuff is a form of doing stuff, and I think reading about stuff is also another form of action. Lots of these people are doing all sorts of things, and some of them are really, I think they're really admirable, and they're difficult things. Like the bloke who's the truck driver, the bus driver from down in the Hora Whenua, he will now have conversations with members of his family about the origins of the land that they come from, which are also confiscated parts of Taranaki. So he'll be sitting at dinner tables and having these awkward conversations. I think that's a really hard thing to do. It's a hell of a lot harder than writing a book. It's harder than going on a protest. There are people who fundraise, and there are people who are writing their own stories, and there's all sorts of stuff that people do, and much of this is motivated by an attempt to live a more honest personal history.
Yeah, you compare those people as the ones who are out the back in the kitchen at a party actually doing the hard yards. Everyone else is sitting around talking, and they're the ones actually getting stuff done and making sure it all happens.
They are quiet people in the main. They don't have the sort of the privilege and the platforms that I have occupationally, but they're just getting on and they're doing the work.
Yeah, just to pick one in particular, person called Marguerite Foxen. Now, it's interesting. She logged onto Papers Past, you know, that extraordinary online resource, to find, she says, hundreds of references to her family name. Eventually, even, I think, discovered a whole second farm near Tabuka, which was in the family, which she didn't even know about. Stuff. So people are discovering stuff like this.
Yeah, absolutely. She got 3,000 and something hits when she went into Papers Past, and she actually discovered three farms. So this is a family who were down there in Te Waipounamu. She grew up knowing about one of those farms, but had no idea that there had been two farms, and she hadn't had any idea either about the extent to which her grandmother, who sounded like a remarkable woman, Ellen Foxen, was involved with church activities in and around Tumuka and Arowhenua Pa, which is one of the major pa sites in Te Waipounamu. And there was Marguerite's story about her grandmother, Ellen Foxen, is a really remarkable example, I think, of uncovering stuff that you didn't know was there, but which is just waiting to be found. It's not hard stuff to uncover. You do need to make the step of going looking for it.
But some of it is, isn't it? Some of it is pretty obscure. I mean, you even made a mention of the fact that some of your story for the Forgotten Coast had actually kind of been suppressed in the press. You wouldn't find it in the Papers Past. Some of it even came out in the House of Commons. Even
That's after the events that happened in the invasion of Parihaka. And Vincent O'Malley is the one you really need to read on this. There was a press blackout, essentially. There was a ban on covering that. But there were a couple of journalists, including one from the Littleton Times, which was thought of as a pro-Māori paper, who snuck in around the back of the pa and witnessed what occurred. But it took 2 years before the government, the colonial administration in this country, formally acknowledged what occurred at and after the invasion of Parihaka, and largely only because of pressure to do so, which came from Westminster, you know, 22,000 miles away. So that is, that is a part of what one of the challenges that I had, specifically because my ancestor was involved in those events around which there was a press blackout. But Papers Past will, for most of us, be all we need, because those were, in those days, papers of record. And so there were enormous amounts of information there. And Marguerite just plugged in Ellen Foxen and got 3,500 hits, which completely changed Marguerite's view of the nature of her family history. I think the point, one of the things that I would take from that is, and it certainly applies to me, it just didn't occur to me to do this. It didn't occur to me to put two and two together and get four. Which is that I come from people on my mum's side who have a very, very strong affinity with and sense of identification with the Taranaki coast. You know, there was a photo in my parents' house when I was growing up of my great-grandfather, who was the captain of the armed constabulary, his rugby team. The photo was taken in 1881. It's taken at Rahutu Domain, which is a sort of half an hour walk from Parihaka. And I was, 52 or 53, maybe a bit older even, when it occurred to me that this must say something about my family history. But I was able to get to that age, to live five decades on this earth, and not put those things together. That's a really good example of what I think Pākehā privilege looks like. The whole term privilege, I think, is problematic. It's not a word I'm comfortable with. It's the only word I've got to play with.
You prefer, don't you, Pākehā structural advantage?
Yeah, but I only prefer that.
What's the difference?
Well, I don't think there is a difference, except I have an issue with the word privilege, because in conventional language, when we use that word, we're often talking about economic privilege, and we're talking about wealth, and we're talking about income flows, and you know, and having a batch and a boat up at the beach or Lake Taupo or whatever the case may be. And that is not the case for many people in this country who nonetheless are able, because they are Pākehā and we don't talk about this stuff, to live in this country as if there are no Māori in it. You can choose to do that. I certainly chose to do that. So, I mean, structural advantage works for me, because when I was a student 400 years ago, that was the language that we used in the sociology classes that I attended. And it just speaks to the way in which the world is organized, so that some people enjoy advantages which are denied to other people, regardless, irrespective of issues of individual merit. But I think it's really important to reflect on what that might mean. And for me, one of the things it means is that when I drive up that road from Palmerston North, glorious place that it is, to New Plymouth to visit my mum who still lives there, I drive around the coast road. It's beautiful. It's a gorgeous road. It's one of my favorite drives in the world. If the Maunga is out, there is this glorious view that sort of sweeps down from the top across out into the ocean, and what I see is a view. But I imagine that the people from whom that land was taken in 1865, and most of it has never been and will never be returned. That land is gone from their futures. It's been harnessed to my story and the story of other people. They would see something different. They might not see the same things that I see. They might see what Rachel Buchanan has called a traumascape. This is land that has been taken from them. So they have been denied the advantages that came through my family. We do have to talk about privilege, but I just find it an uncomfortable word to use because of the connotations, the narrow connotation that it speaks solely to economic privilege.
We have a text here from a listener that will interest you. I too have a great grandfather from Limerick who was a policeman in Taranaki. As a result of a little online research, I found things that link him to Parihaka as well. I know he was a highly respected policeman for many years and a good man, but the fact he did take part is a shameful part of history, says this listener. Those two facts can both be true. I'm looking forward to reading Richard's account, and I totally agree we cannot afford to forget history. It has happened.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's a thoughtful, balanced piece of thinking, I think, because these were very often good people. They're not bad people by virtue of being caught up in a military campaign against Tangata Whenua or an agricultural campaign which completed the alienation of that land, and not only in Taranaki. And it's not just about confiscations either. But I like the way that what that person has done is said, these things can be true, and very often were true. So it is not a matter of denying one in order to address the other. They both need to be brought together, I think, in a different kind of way of thinking about our settler stories.
And it is people like this who form the basis of the book, Other People's Stories, in your book, The Unsettled. But in the book, Richard, you also say that the voices of Tangata Whenua are seldom present in this book. And in explaining that, you quote Rachel Buchanan, the writer and historian, who's Te Ati Awa, who you've mentioned before, is saying some stories are not ours to tell. But then separately, a few pages later, you say often Māori are not there at all. They are the absence that is always present, shunted aside by the bustling endeavour required to build a colony and put down roots and make a better life. That settler pioneer orthodoxy, or however you put it, like I mentioned earlier. But are those things a little contradictory? You're saying we can't tell these stories, they're not ours to tell, and then you say they're an absence that's right throughout the book?
The fact that they are an absence in the book is the telling point, I think. And there are a couple of things that I'd say to that. They're absent partly because it isn't my place to tell another Pākehā version of the invasion of Parihaka. What is my place is to talk about my people's role in that. So it is my responsibility. It has almost become a sense of a moral obligation not to tell other people's stories, but to tell mine. Because what we do in this country so often is that we look outside and we claim this, and I should have access to that, and that's mine to know, and I have a right to this other thing, and I should be able to express my opinion on anything and everything that moves. And sometimes I think it's better if we don't do that. Sometimes I increasingly think that it is important for people like me, and maybe others who share something like my history, just to step back and to not claim things, but instead to think, just to think about what is ours, what we are responsible for. So what I say in the book about the unsettled is there's kind of no Māori in there at all, because this isn't a story about Māori. This Māori people have enough of their own work to be getting on with. In my view, there is a job of work for Pākehā people to do, and that's what I'm having a crack at in that book, The Unsettled. That's my story. It's my responsibility to tell that, and not to turn away or to hide or to deflect or to ignore it by going away and picking up other people's cool stories. That's their business. My job is to say, I didn't know this stuff. It's been profoundly unsettling for me. It's kind of messed with my sense of not only the kind of person I am, but the kind of people I am part of, and the sort of country that I am a citizen of. And I just need to do some of my own work around making a different kind of sense of those things. So that's, I think, what I'm trying to get at when I talk about not telling other people's
No,
stories.
sure,
Because,
that makes sense, yeah. But Newsroom, reviewing a book, called it Pākehā Guilt, the sequel, was the heading they put on the review. I wonder what you make of that, because it is something you sort of tackle, in a sense, in the book. You refer to Margaret Mead, you know, back in the 1970s, talking about, you know, good guilt for societies to have when reinvestigating their past, and then revising it in later years to something she called useful guilt. And I'm not sure what the difference is, or whether you feel the same way.
Connor, I come, and I think I talk about this in both of those books. I was raised in the Catholic Church. Now, we know quite a lot about guilt in the Catholic Church. I'm not sure there's anything that anybody can teach me about guilt, having been raised a Catholic. One of the things that guilty people do is they go to ground. They stay silent. They don't write books about this kind of stuff. That is not the sign of a guilty person. Guilt, at least the Catholic version of it, is something that is deeply internalized, and it can do all sorts of terrible things to a person and to their relationships with their significant other people in their lives. What I'm interested in is the way in which guilt is weaponized in this country in particular. So almost every single one of the flaming emails and messages that I got, which were attempting to put me in my place and shut me down, used the word guilt. So the assumption on the part of the people who took issue with what I said in The Forgotten Coast, and who won't like The Unsettled at all, and who won't bother reading it, I'm sure, is the accusation that it's all motivated by guilt, which makes precisely no sense to me. If I was completely kind of crippled by guilt, as I have been by other things at different times in my life, I would not be writing these books. I'd just be hiding in a dark corner somewhere, telling everybody to leave me alone. So this is not about guilt. This is about responsibility. And that exchange that you referred to between Margaret Mead and James Baldwin, the great civil rights activist, I think it took place in the early 1970s in New York.
Yeah,
there's an exchange around American civil rights between Baldwin and Mead, and Mead proposes that guilt can be useful in the sense that it can motivate people. Bad guilt is the stuff that cripples you. Good guilt is the stuff that makes you think, oh, good guilt is what pisses you off. Good guilt is the stuff that thinks, I know this stuff, it's bad, it shouldn't happen, or it's wrong, or whatever the case may be. But there is a sort of an emotional energy that can come from that, that can propel you forward and can encourage you to take responsibility for a thing and to address it, whatever it might be. But both Baldwin and Mead, I think, walked away from the notion of guilt. And I much prefer the one of responsibility, because I think that's much more accurate. What I feel, and what the other people whose voices are heard in this book feel, is just a quiet sense of responsibility for doing something. And the doing might be listening, or it might be talking, or it might be standing back, or it might be stepping forward, or it might be learning a better version of your own history. There's no guilt there.
You do say, though, in the book, Richard, you do say towards the end, like, I'm only, when you kind of address this, how you want people to respond, I'm only suggesting, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but you say more or less, I'm only suggesting that you, the reader, think about this stuff, you know, in terms of your own history and situation. And it, you even use the words, it's not my place to tell you what to do. But there is an element of that, isn't it? You do want people to confront that and maybe check whether they need to feel guilty or not, at the least.
I'd like people to think. I mean, this won't be relevant to all people. Clearly, we have really different biographies in this place. But I do think we all share regardless of when our people came here, whether that was a year ago or 150 or 200 years ago, we share a political genealogy, and the genealogy stretches back to colonization. There's a beautiful poem by Dinah Hawken in which the line, "We are all beneficiaries of injustice here," appears. And I really like that line. So whether or not your ancestor was at Parihaka or not, we are all beneficiaries of what took place here. That's what I'd like people to reflect on. Whatever they feel when they go through that process is for them to feel. Most of the people who I've worked with in order to produce The Unsettled don't feel guilt at all. They feel various things. Often they do feel anger. They feel anger about not having known, and they wonder why they didn't know these things. They wonder why there is not a different kind of story told about colonization, both the big C and the little C of colonization in this country. But then they're just motivated to crack on and fill in the gaps and to tell their own stories differently. Guilt may well be in there, but if it is, I think it's a passing phase. It may be one of the stages that people go through and think, oh, shit, I didn't know that. And I might feel this. I might feel slightly guilty about this. But then they are propelled forward into something that more closely resembles responsibility. So I think that is what I'm really wary of, I don't like, it's not my place to advise or to offer a manual or to suggest this is best practice or any of that stuff. There's nothing like that, I hope, in the book. But I think what there might be is an invitation, if any of that stuff resonates, is an invitation to think about where you are and how you came to be and the history of the place in which you live, the land that you have grown up on, or the land where your kids go to school or your places of worship or whatever the case may be. That land always tells a story. We don't always know what they are. It's not hard to find. And I think that might be the invitation in the book, is to deal with that sense of being unsettled by just learning more about the places on which we stand.
Yeah, even if you come to the conclusion in the end yourself that, you know, you have to live in the world as it is and all of that. But I just wonder, you have made me think about my own situation. So I'm a first-generation New Zealander. My parents came from the UK in the 1960s, so I guess I don't have the sort of history you have from that earlier colonial period, but I don't get a pass, do I?
I think you get a different kind of pass, Colin. I think that for somebody in circumstances such as yours, and many of the people who live here will have very similar stories to yours. Post-war economic depression, blasted landscapes in war-torn Europe, and they come here in search of a better life. So they don't, their ancestors, your ancestors, don't participate in the initial phases of colonization in quite the same way that mine did. But I don't know where you live, but you're gonna have, if presuming you're down in Wellington to Whanganui Aotearoa.
That's,
I mean,
right.
there are dodgy land deals down there. The history of that place was not particularly comforting for Tangata Whenua. If you live in Christchurch, you know, if you're part of what was the Kemp Purchase, 20 million acres worth of land, nearly a third of the entire country, purchased by the Crown on the promise that 10% of it would be returned to Mana Whenua, and in the event, something like 0.031% of that land was handed back. So it isn't just about the confiscations in Taranaki or the Waikato or Te Orawera or Whakatoia Rohe. It's not just about that. It is about some of the really dubious, dishonest, illicit, immoral land dealings that took place in other parts of the country. And maybe, Colin, you live on that land. You don't need to put a hair shirt on. There needn't be any self-flagellation. None of that stuff is especially helpful. No one's calling for it. Maybe what is worth doing, though, is just picking up the Waitangi Tribunal's report about Te Whanganui Aotearoa. And I'm not, Colin, I don't want to sound like I'm telling you to do this, but I mean, it's kind of interesting to find out about the land you live on. And so it's not a question of culpability. I think the language, the punitive language that is used by people who want to shut these conversations down, it's just bullshit, and it's unhelpful. It is just a matter of living better with ourselves and framing the way we are in this place so that there is a better way of thinking about the future. I think allowing this conversation between what happened in the deep past and the more recent past and the present and into the future, by just knowing a bit more than many of us, myself included, tend to.
And I suppose now that I think about it, my partner, her family did come out in the first four ships into Canterbury. So yeah, there's that. Anyway, look, it's been fascinating. It's been fascinating talking to you this morning, Richard. The book is The Unsettled, Small Stories of Colonisation by Richard Shaw. It's Massey University Press has published that. The feedback is coming in droves on that, Richard, so we'll try to get back to some of that later in the hour, and that's appropriate given that it was the feedback to your first book, The Forgotten Coast, that prompted The Unsettled. But thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Colin.
Cheers.